Wendy Harmer on ABC Radio Sydney.
I promise you an amazing Eora Nation today, and I've got one for you. Yes, I don't like to let you down. I have a guest in the studio. His name is Paul Irish. The book is called Hidden in Plain View. And it says here, I'll read you a little bit more, the Aboriginal people of coastal Sydney, that's who it's about. And Stan Grant, he writes the foreword for this, and he says, Paul Irish has breathed a new life into people written out of history. And it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because we tend to have a very, I don't know, a very archaic view, I suppose, or a very almost a racist view of what people contributed to Sydney. We look at rock carvings, we look at middens, we look at artefacts like spears or clapsticks, and it's almost like we put Aboriginal culture in aspic, under glass, that it finished, and that what happened was after the First Fleet arrived, everyone just vanished, or the Indigenous population just vanished, or lots of them were killed. But what about this idea? What about if they never went anywhere and that they've been here all this time and hidden in plain view? That's the title of the book. Well, welcome, Paul. It's lovely to have you along.
Yes, thank you, Wendy. It's great to be here.
Now, you have taken a long time to write this. You're an historian, and this has been 10 years in the research. Tell us a little bit about the research.
Yes, well, look, I started working about 15 years ago or so as an archaeologist, and in my archaeology work, like you were mentioning in the introduction, we tend to focus a lot on stone artefacts, rock engravings, these kind of ancient traces of Aboriginal Sydney. But as I started to work with Aboriginal people, I realised that the story of their lives after 1788 was certainly not being reflected in the work I did as an archaeologist, but also wasn't really written about in an accessible way and in a way that really could let you understand what had happened after 1788. So I started, around 10 years ago, started pulling together the information I could find that other people had been researching, and also started to do some original research of my own, and together with researchers from the La Perouse Aboriginal community, who some of whom have ancestral ties that go a long time back in Sydney. And it's really been a case of pulling together tiny fragments of information to the level where we can actually paint a bigger picture. And that's why it's taken some time to pull this together, because I wanted to provide the context, the bigger story that that the Aboriginal people within Sydney through the 19th century, what were they doing, where were they living, give that sense of explaining how they were able to live and why it is that they have been written out of history in many cases.
And it's an interesting one. You say that they've been here all the time, but tell me what the sort of prevailing idea has been all these years.
I think it's been a mixture of things. I think if you look up, and many of your listeners would be aware of this from their own particular parts of Sydney, you look up local history books of particular parts of Sydney, and they'll often have a reference to an Aboriginal camp that was down the back of someone's farm or on a beach. They might talk about the last of their tribe living in a certain area in the 19th century, and then there's sort of silence after this. And the important thing, though, is that these stories are there all over Sydney about people who continued to live in Sydney. There just hasn't been a context to put their lives into. And when we started to put all of these stories together and weave it into an actual overall story, it really, a picture emerged of people who continued to live in Sydney but were overlooked at the time because they were often not considered to be authentically Aboriginal. They weren't living the lives of their grandparents and great-grandparents, and they were often had mixed ancestry, so they weren't considered to be fully Aboriginal in that way. So at the time, I think they were ignored for that reason. And until quite recently, historians have just not been that interested in understanding these stories.
So the typical comment, I guess, is that we get or that we read in history books is that after the First Fleet arrived, that the local Indigenous folks, their population was decimated, that they were driven out, they disappeared. Are you saying that, or the obverse is that they were, I suppose, absorbed and integrated? Are you saying that neither is quite true?
Yeah, I think it's a lot more complicated. We tend to view history as either European history or Aboriginal history, and that's blinded us a bit, I guess, to the fact that the Aboriginal people who continued to live in the coastal part of Sydney did so by retaining a strong sense of identity and connection and tradition, but also by embracing new ways of living and by forming relationships with the Europeans around them and by entering the colonial economy. And it's, I guess, a fault of us as observers to that, that we haven't recognised that as Aboriginality. We've seen that as losing connection rather than
That's
adapting.
Right. A lot of people would say, oh, they've lost their traditional ways, that they're not Aboriginal anymore.
Yeah, I think the thing is, though, that you can trace through generations alive today and right back to the time of the First Fleet, that every single generation in that time in coastal Sydney has lived and identified as Aboriginal. Their lives have obviously changed greatly in that time, but they have never ceased to be Aboriginal people and to identify. And certainly families in the La Perouse Aboriginal community, their ancestry goes back in Sydney, you know, many hundreds of generations. And their immediate ancestors, their grandparents, great-grandparents, great-grandparents, they expressed their identity not necessarily explicitly by saying repeatedly, I'm Aboriginal, but they did so by living in Aboriginal settlements, by continuing to live and interact and marry and travel with other Aboriginal people up and down the coast.
You have found the some extraordinary records here, and you've followed some individuals, Johnny Malone and Biddy Giles. And tell us about some of the individuals you followed and how difficult it was to find this information about their lives.
In some ways, it was not that difficult to find out that they existed. Mm-hmm. I think in a lot of ways, despite all the research that I've done, there's also a whole lot of people that sit in the background of this book as unnamed individuals. So it has been quite easy to find something about these people, but to actually piece together where they lived, where they married, who their parents were, how they travelled, how they might have seen the evolving colonial world of Sydney, that's been difficult. And it's really been a very painstaking process of linking tiny references to particular people. One person that I would give as an example, and he has a story that occurred very close to here, actually, in Darling Harbour. It was a man named William Annan, and he's written about a bit in the book. He was born probably around the 1790s, so this was the period immediately after the smallpox epidemic. His family would have obviously been affected by that, and he was affiliated with the Port Hacking region, sort of down towards Royal National Park. But he had a lot to do with Europeans in Sydney. We know that he worked as a police tracker in the 1820s, and by the 1830s he was a sought-after fishing and hunting guide for Europeans who wanted to do those things. And many of those were the first generation of Europeans to be born in Sydney, the children of convicts often. And in the 1830s he was out on one of his fishing trips in Darling Harbour and was stung by a catfish on his arm, and he was taken to hospital. It was a very poisonous bite, and he eventually had to have his arm amputated. But he continued to live and fish around Sydney, but his ability to work and earn money was obviously diminished by that. And eventually he came into Sydney in 1844 to collect his annual blanket, which the governments gave out every winter. And unknown to him, the government had cancelled that policy after 20 years that year. And he died the next day in the middle of winter in Hyde Park. And this is a tragic story and a tragic ending to a young life. But what's really interesting is what happened after that, which is within a week, several of his European friends formed a committee to raise money for the remaining Sydney people, to buy them a fishing boat, tackle and other gear to assist them in being self-sufficient and making money. And it just shows how people like William Annan, who's really flown under the radar, I mean, few people have really heard of him apart from some historians, how they're really typical of the kind of relationships that forged. He was of this new generation. He created a new life for himself, and he established a trend, I guess, of Europeans interacting with Aboriginal people, and which was part of their strategy of being able to remain in Sydney.
The foreword that Stan Grant has written, he says, "I've been trying to find Frank Foster for most of my life, not anymore. Frank is alive to me, a man who existed only as a name buried in my family's past is now flesh and blood." And Frank Foster was Stan's great-great-grandfather. And he said his name appeared fleetingly in Aboriginal mission records. And he was known as the school teacher, and Stan said he was puzzled by this. How could he be a school teacher in the 19th century? And then he met you, and you helped him flesh out the history of his great-grandfather. There must be so many people, Paul, who are wandering around and looking for these records and trying to trace their people. And you've been able to fill that in here. And he says, as you say in this book, he was living in plain sight.
Yes, absolutely. I think this is one of the good illustrations. There's plenty of people like Frank Foster, and actually at the time that Stan became aware of the research that we were doing, I was working with some Aboriginal researchers from La Perouse to put together an exhibition featuring some of these individuals and their lives. And Frank Foster is typical of a lot of people. He grew up in a time, I guess this is the story of the book, is that between about the 1840s and the early 1880s, the government, which was based in Sydney, had no policies and virtually no interaction at all with Aboriginal people. And that's something that's very hard to believe from the 20th and 21st century, where we know of all of these horrible government intrusions into Aboriginal people's lives. But there was this space of about half a century where personal relationships were formed between Aboriginal people and Europeans, and that often allowed them to remain living in close to fishing grounds and where they could earn a living. And a lot of this has been sort of overshadowed by everything that's happened since. And Frank Foster grew up in that time. He grew up as a young boy towards the end of that time. And as a young boy, he also experienced the start of the Aboriginal missions. There was two Aboriginal missions in Western New South Wales, and he was taken down there as a young boy and grew up there. And that's where he met Stan's great-great-grandmother. And that's the story of how Stan, on one side of his family, links into a person that really spent a lot of his time on the coast.
Yeah. You say you, with this book, you want to start a conversation. What's the conversation that you want us to have?
I think that people should be aware of a few things, and I hope that the book kind of starts that conversation. One is that we've tended to divide history into a layer of Aboriginal history that sits below and under and is obscured by the European history. And Hidden in Plain View not only refers to the history, it refers to the places around Sydney. There's a lot of buildings around Sydney that we regard as historic houses, and we subconsciously associate that purely with their European history. But many of those buildings had associations for Aboriginal people too, and properties and other places around Sydney that we can still see today and recognise in the landscape. That history's always been there. It's just, until you point it out, it's not immediately obvious.
Yeah, yeah. And you make, of course, the point is where we started from, is that we're more likely to see a shell midden or a cockle shell scraper or a shell fish hook and go, "Oh, Aboriginal people were here once." And the point you make is they never left.
That's right. One of my favourite stories is a man in the 1930s who was recalling his childhood in the eastern suburbs in about the 1870s, and he recalled a group of Aboriginal people spearfishing from the rocks at Rose Bay. Mm-hmm. So this is nearly a century after the First Fleet, and they were using a traditional fishing spear, but the prongs on the end of the fishing spear were replaced by umbrella wires. And Aboriginal people at La Perouse, I know, make the same spears. They use pram spokes and all sorts of things. This is not losing Aboriginality. This is continuing culture. Mm. It's an adaptation. We allow every other culture in the world to adapt and change, but somehow Aboriginal people have to stay the same or they lose something. And I think that the people that I work with are proudly Aboriginal, and they recognise their continuing associations, and I think that's a conversation we should start to have too.
Yeah, well, it is a beautiful book, I have to say, Paul. It's got so many great photos in it and historic records. You've got these incredible photos of Double Bay and Darling Point and New South Head Road and all these places that, just so fabulous, these very old photos, and that, of course, we don't really associate with having an Aboriginal population at all.
No, that's
right.
No
one thinks of New South Head Road and thinks, oh, well, Aboriginal people lived here.
No, that's right. But I think that's one of the things too, is that it's not just the Aboriginal history that's a bit hidden in plain view. If you stood on Bondi Beach during the First World War and looked behind Bondi Beach, you would have seen sand dunes and swamps, no houses, and you would have been able to walk through to Rose Bay without probably seeing anyone else. I mean, until at least the end of the 19th century, most of the eastern suburbs was very sparsely occupied. Mm-hmm. And that's not the only reason Aboriginal people were able to remain there, but it does give you an insight that's not obvious today. When you drive around the eastern suburbs today, it's so densely populated by what looks to be quite old houses. You forget that most of them are not more than about 100 years old. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're dealing with nearly 250 years of history here.
I live in a 100-year-old house myself. It doesn't feel that old. Well, it does feel that old, actually, when it rains. It's a beautiful book. Thank you so much for writing it. And I hope it really does spark that conversation that you want to have. Good on you. Paul Irish is the man. The book is Hidden in Plain View, The Aboriginal People of Coastal Sydney. And it is out through New South. Thank you so much for joining us, Paul.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks.
I very much appreciate you coming along. We're all fighting about this book, who gets to take it home. So you've really sparked a conversation around here, that's for sure. Thanks so much.
You're with Wendy Harmer. ABC Radio Sydney.